it's time for Kelly Can Help, hosted by Jeff Kelly, attorney at law with the law office of Jeffrey B. Kelly. And now, here's Jeff Kelly.
All right. We've got David Blevins on our show today. I am excited to have David. David, what I'd like for you to do is just introduce you to my clients and my listeners. And if you don't mind, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your practice, and your area of specialty.
Well, it's good to be here, Jeff. It's good to be here. I've been practicing for 35 years, all here in Dalton. I got out of the University of Georgia Law School. My practice now consists of really two areas of emphasis. I do car wrecks and personal injury, which is what I've traditionally done for 34 years. But in the last 5 or 6 years in particular, I have done a lot of the probate and estate work. And I've done probate litigation. I kind of backed into it. I never planned to do this. But my wife, we practiced law together from the 80s after our first child was born. She was practicing in Chattanooga, but she was the probate lawyer and had a large probate practice. And so when cases would go sour, I was doing the litigation. So she would say, I would just come into the office and there'd be a file on my desk. And pretty soon I realized that was a probate case that now needed litigation. So that's kind of how I learned to do it. And I've been doing that about 20 years. And then I've just gotten into compliance work about 5 or 6 years.
Excellent. Excellent. And let's see here. Where'd you go for undergrad?
I went to Carson Newman College in Jefferson City, Tennessee.
Excellent.
Little Baptist school up in East Tennessee. About 30 miles above Knoxville.
Yeah, I'm real familiar with that school. Good school. So how did you end up from Carson Newman to the University of Georgia?
Well, that's a good question. I was, when I got an undergraduate, I was dead broke and needed a job. So I was behind a girl sitting behind me in church one Sunday, and she told me, she said that her mother was a teacher in the Atlanta area. And encouraged me to apply where her mother was a teacher in the Douglas County school system.
Yeah.
So I did, because I was desperate and you couldn't buy a job back in 1979. So I applied in the fall of 79, and by God's great grace and providence, they had an opening. One of the history teachers there at Lithia Springs High School was taking a job as a principal at another school. Mm-hmm. So they had an opening, and by the grace of God, they hired me. So I started in December of 1979 teaching history and social studies. I wound up teaching history and math, algebra and geometry at Lithia Springs High School. So I became an in-state student. And as a poor college student and a poor teacher, I needed a school that I could afford. So I applied and was accepted at the University of Georgia. I'd like to tell you I applied to the University of Georgia because I knew it was a great school. I applied because it was the only one I could afford, but it turned out that it was a great school, and so it was a great experience.
Wonderful. And, how many years did you teach?
I taught 3 years. I taught math. I taught, history my first year, 79-80 school year.
Yeah.
And then they found out that I had a math minor, so I got drafted to teach geometry and algebra, as well as American history, my last 2 years. So I taught for 3 years total.
So was it your plan all along to go to law school, or?
No, it was not. That's a good question. I did pretty well in the law classes, like con law as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
And so my advisor and con law teacher, professor, encouraged me to go to law school. And so I finally talked me into it. So I filled out an application and I paid to go take the LSAT, the law school entrance exam.
Yeah.
Well, I decided in the meantime, I really didn't want to do that because I thought the law would be too tedious. And that was my professor's goal anyway. So I didn't study. I didn't do any reviews. I didn't do anything. The Saturday morning that the LSAT would be offered there on campus at Carson Newman, I woke up early and looked at the ceiling, looked at the clock and said, if I go to the cafeteria, I can make it and I've already paid for it. So why not? So I got out of bed and went and took the LSAT. I didn't do super well on it because I'd never even taken a practice test.
Yeah.
But I was able to get into, I was accepted. They said, where do you want to send your grades? And I said, UT was the only place I knew, which is where some good company went to law school.
That's right.
You UT graduate. So I was accepted to UT law school, but I decided not to go. I was too broke to go. I literally was too broke. I didn't have any way to sustain myself while I was in law school. So I got a teaching job, and I considered being an engineer. I went and interviewed with the folks at Georgia Tech about being an engineer.
Wow.
I interviewed with a few seminaries about doing a PhD in church history. I applied to and was accepted to the graduate program, a PhD program at the University of Georgia. And I went over there and I decided I wanted to be a college history professor. And Dr. Holmes, the chairman of the department, when he told me he'd be glad for me to come and they offered me whatever the money they offered me, I said, well, Dr. Holmes, do you think I'll be able to get a job doing what you're doing when I get a PhD from here? And he looked at the floor and said, I must be honest. And then looked at me. So I knew it wouldn't be good. So on my way back to Douglasville from Athens, God and I had a talk in my Volkswagen about the necessity of eating. And so I didn't go do the PhD program. I applied to law school the next year and was accepted to the University of Georgia Law School. And that's how I got there.
And now you know the rest of the story.
That's right.
How'd you meet your wife?
Well, my second year in law school, my first year in law school, I joined Christian Legal Society, and I worked in Christian Legal Society a lot. And they elected my best friend, John Lewis, to be the president of Christian Legal Society. Second year, the officers of Christian Legal Society were always second years. The third years were too sorry to do anything. So, you know, they're just like high school seniors. Plus, we had the bar. Back in those days, you took the bar February of your last year. So the first semester, you studied for the bar. The second semester, you weren't worth shooting. So, and the first years don't know what's going on. So the second years were always the officers. So John was elected president. I was elected vice president. And so when we had the Christian Legal Social in the fall, a really, really, really pretty girl named Sherry Henson showed up and was interested in coming to Christian Legal Society. So I decided I'd check that out, and I've been checking it out ever since.
Excellent. All right. Well, in your practice now, who is your typical client now?
The typical client now is, it depends on, that's a great question. On the probate side, it's mainly just middle-class folks.
Yeah.
I do some of the larger estates, but typically it's somebody that's leaving a house and got three kids and a dog and a 401k and two vehicles. And they'll come in, either their family will come in to probate the will or the estate, or they will come in to do their wills and do their estate plans. So on that side, that would be typically, I represent middle America. I represent just common folks. And then on the car wreck side, it's anybody. All you have to be is in a car wreck and somebody run a red light and hit you.
Yeah.
So some of those are they run the range from people that are that do not have many means at all to folks that are very wealthy.
Yeah. All right. You know, I have a lot of clients who they just really put off getting a will. Can you tell my clients what happens to them when somebody dies and there is no will? Why do they need to get one?
Very often it's a mess. And this is why I'll start with the young folks. young people often think they don't need wills. They don't need wills because I don't have a whole lot. The bank is, you know, I've got a house or I've got a car, but it's mortgage. So I don't, you know, well, first of all, hopefully your life insurance is going to take care of that. But you have two reasons why when you're young, you needed to have a will. First is you have children. And let's say you and your spouse are killed in a car wreck. If that happens, typically the mother's family and the dad's family both want the child. So you're going to have a judge, you're going to have a 45-minute hearing, and they're going to decide who's going to take care of your child for the rest of their lives. You know that, you know who should take care of your child far better than the judge does. And the judge would be very relieved if you took that burden away. And so it may not be one of your in-laws. They might not be the best fit. It may be because of their age or their circumstance. It may not be even a family member. But if it is, the parents of that child need to set that out because that's their responsibility. And the second is young people think that if I die, then what I have, what we've worked for, goes to my wife. Not necessarily. Georgia law says that a surviving spouse gets a child's part of the estate. First, they get all the estate if there's no children. But if there's any children, they get a child's part, but at least a third. So let's say that you've got two minor children. If you got two children, and they can be ages 2 and 5, and you die, then your wife or your husband doesn't own that house. They own a third of that house. And maybe they need to move. Maybe they need to change, relocate for a job, whatever the case might be. Well, they've got a problem selling the house, because they own it with their children. And then the proceeds of that house, instead of going to take care of the family necessity, is going to have to be put into conservatorship accounts for the children. And the truth is, the surviving spouse can probably spend that money for the kids and maintain a home better than a court can do with supervision.
Yeah.
But if you don't make the law, that's what happens. Now, for the older people, the folks that are, let's say, in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, what happens, especially if you've got families, children by different marriages, well, if you, let's say, you're married and to a lady that has a small child, and you raise that child, you may want that child to share in your estate if something happens to you and your wife, especially if you work to it together. If you leave a will, you can do that. If you don't leave a will, that child gets nothing. And so often happens is that once a spouse survives has to share that with children, grown children, which may or may not be good. Or they may get the surviving spouse may get it all through a will, but then that will leave one set of children out. So a well thought out will is really vital to long term family harmony. You know, what I do is I take care of families. I'm not taking care of property.
Yeah.
Really. But we're taking care of people.
Yeah.
Wills and probate is a people business. It's not a paper business. Most folks in law school think it's a paper business. But if you do your will right and take care of your family right, what you can do is keep down a lot of conflict and hard feelings and heartache among your children as brothers and sisters, between your stepchildren and their mother. All that can be well managed with a well thought out will.
What about when people do get into a fight over an estate? Would you say that the cost of you know, litigating an estate where there is no will is going to greatly exceed the cost of doing the will if somebody had just thought ahead?
Oh, absolutely. Wills here, a will package here starts at about $750 and goes up to about $2,000 unless you really need some complicated tax stuff. And I quoted a state litigation the other day at $15,000 to $20,000.
Wow. That's a huge difference. Wow. What about for, do you ever have any clients where you plan for, you know, maybe they've got a spouse, a child who's not so great with money, and maybe they might need somebody to manage that money for them so they don't inherit it and just kind of run off and blow it. Do you do trusts and things like that?
Yes, we do. We do a testamentary trust. We do some inter vivos trust here. That means while in life. But often, most of the time, those are testamentary trusts. And you know that comes up in two ways. Often it's age. Dumping a few $100,000 on an 18-year-old is just not a good thing to do.
Right.
You're better off to put the money in a pile and burn it, because you will do more harm to the child most of the time than you'll do good.
And
that's why a testamentary trust, a well thought out testamentary trust. And one of the things that people don't think about so much, they think about who they trust as a trustee, but they also need to think about who the beneficiary trusts. Often letting an older sibling be the trustee of a trust is a bad idea, because it creates bad blood between the siblings.
That's
one reason that it helps to have an experienced estate lawyer, is because I've been doing this. I've been litigating estates for 25 or 30 years. So I see what works and what doesn't, and what causes damage in the family. And so we can try to help folks avoid that. I can try to help folks avoid that. And we do that a lot with trust. And then there's a lot to talk about. Sometimes you have somebody that gets into substances or is a spendthrift.
Right.
And that's the difference. The first one's kind of easy. We get folks to dole that money out. When you wind up with children that have can't manage money when they're older, or either because of substance abuse or because of poor judgment, That's a delicate situation, but unfortunately, a lot of people don't want to face that, They leave behind a mess and heartache, and they don't do their children any favors.
Do you think it's too harsh to say that, hey, if you care anything about your children, you will get a will done? Why do you think so many people just put it off or just don't want to even contemplate it?
Well, there are two primary reasons for that. First, to do a will, you have to think about dying, and some folks don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And while I'm not morbid, thinking about dying on occasion is a healthy thing. First, it makes you contemplate the destiny of your soul.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I ask will clients or people that sign a will, where will you be when this will is probated? And there's really only two options. Okay. Folks will either be in heaven or they'll be in hell. And that decision, that the preparation for where the soul will spend is more important than where your money will spend.
Amen. So,
a little bit of reflection on the fact that we won't live forever is a good thing spiritually. And it also is a good thing for your family.
Yeah.
The second reason people don't want to do wills is they don't want to face their family. They've got kids that are fussing and fighting, or might have, or they've got some hard feelings, or a spouse that there's some tough decisions have to be made. And frankly, they don't have the guts to face it.
Yeah.
So what they do is nothing and die. And then the family is in a real mess. And that is actually pretty selfish. Now, I hate to be harsh, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to have to do your will. Somebody's going to have to dispose of your property. And you need to look the kids in the eye and say, this is the way I want it to be. Not leave the brothers or the sisters just to fight over it.
How often do you think people should get their wills redone? We had a client come in and he had a will from 1984.
Well, 84 is too long because self-proving wheels came into Georgia in 85. You need to have your wheels done. And by the way, Georgia has really good wheel law, as most states go. So you need to change your wheel when you have substantial life change in life circumstance. I have a lot of folks come in, and the wheels were drawn when the kids were little. They probably ought to name one of their children as their executor now that, you know, they've got a child as a CPA in 35. They probably don't need Uncle Joe, who may not or may not still be alive, to be the executor of the will. So you need to change it on life circumstances as your children advance. You may not need trust provisions. You may be simpler. You also need, if you have substantial circumstance changes, if you have situations where you're going to come into or have a lot of unanticipated money, then you may want to include a charity. You may want to divide your money. If you've got there are certain tax deferred instruments like 401ks that if they grow to a certain level, you may want to, especially if your children are young, do a see-through trust. So if you have your, you need to check with a lawyer if your life circumstances change substantially. If you get married or you're divorced, you really need to have your will looked into. People don't realize it, but if you have a will and remarry, what you've done is revoke a third of your will. Mm-hmm. Now, that causes a lot of heartache because the Georgia statute just says that that the spouse's portion, the will is not good as to the spouse's portion. And to the spouse's portion, your will is revoked. Now, many be the lawyer and probate judge to scratch their head to exactly what does that mean? What does it mean to revoke a third of your will? But it means it's a mess. And it didn't have to be. You could have come into a lawyer. And also, I recommend if you've got older couples, you got folks in their 60s or 70s that have some assets, a prenuptial agreement is a good idea. And people think it's not. And I'm going to tell you why it's a good idea. It keeps your children, the adult children of the people that are getting married, from fighting with each other over who's going to inherit mom and dad's stuff. If you have a prenuptial agreement that sets out who's to get what, then the children, the adult children, are less likely to tear apart the later in life marriage. Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen many times, and it's tragic. But yeah. A prenuptial agreement or, in the alternative, a good will, and just show it to the kids. Okay, Mary is leaving all of her stuff is going to her kids after the last of us to die, and all of my stuff is going to you guys after the last of us to die, and that's the way it's going to be. Leave us alone. And there you go.
What happens when somebody passes and nobody can find the will? Is will any good at all to anybody?
Well, that can be a real problem. If there is a conformed copy and you can explain the absence of the original, and if everybody agrees, it sometimes doesn't take too much explaining to convince the probate court. You can, and I've got one will right now that I'm about to file that's a conformed copy from 1992 or three, and another will that's already in process. So we can work with copies sometimes, but that's a heartburn that we really don't need to have. So we have a little speech about where you should put your will. And you can put them in your safety deposit box. If you have any doubt, is there going to be any fussing and fighting or any questions or any strife about your will, I recommend filing it with the probate court for safekeeping. It costs $15. It lasts a lifetime. The probate court will not read your will. They will put your name on it, give it a number, and file it in a fireproof filing cabinet. It's all provided by statute. No one can come and get your will unless it's you and you can prove your identity, or they show up with your death certificate and prove they're an heir. Then they can get a copy. That way it's locked up, and nobody has to wonder what dad's will was, because it's right there in the probate court already.
How about that? That's a neat thing to know.
Well, very few folks know that. And it does keep down a lot of fussing and fighting. And I file at least one will with the probate court a month. You can also keep it in a fireproof box at your house, but the safety deposit box or safekeeping with the probate court is by far the best way to do it. You need to let somebody know where it is in your papers. Just keep a receipt, the $15 receipt that the probate court gives you that your will was filed. And they go, oh, Dad filed the will with the probate court. They'll trot down and the probate court will not give them the will, but the probate court will give them a copy if they present a death certificate to show you that you're not around and proof that you are an heir or a beneficiary under the will.
How about that? That's good to know. Well, do you ever have clients come in and meet with you, you know, to do a will or personal injury where you say to yourself, gosh, I wish you had known this, or I wish you hadn't done fill in the blank. Like, you know, for me, I have clients come in and they'll spend through their 401ks, you know, paying debts off that we are going to wipe out anyway. You ever experienced that?
Boy, do I. And that's a great question, Jeff. You're good at this, you know. we need to make you on the late show for lawyers. So, yes, we do. We do have people that come in and with their car insurance, sometimes it's pretty painful. That they will do things like not give the hospital their car insurance information because they think the other guy's car insurance ought to take care of it. Well, when you do that, you're not taking advantage of the discounts that your insurance contractually receives from the hospital. Right now, medical bills, this is something people wouldn't think about. Medical bills are inflated 60 to 75% of what the insurance contractual rates are. So if you go to the hospital, you have a car wreck, and not too much is wrong with you, but they do a good bit of tests, you know, put your arm in a splint or a neck brace and send you home, it's not unusual to have a $10,000 bill. If your health insurance where you work paid that bill, their contractual discount would most likely reduce that bill to $3,000 or $4,000.
Wow.
So if the other guy's got a $25,000 automobile policy and you have a broken arm, which is not a high dollar thing, a broken arm, which is a pretty serious injury, and a $10,000 hospital bill, if the car insurance, the other guy's car insurance pays that $10,000, then there's only $15,000 left in that policy for you. If your insurance where you work pays the bill, it pays $4,000. Then when you collect the $25,000 from the other guy's life insurance, car insurance, you pay your insurance company back $4,000. So instead of having $15,000 to work with, you've got $21,000 to work with. So that you see people come in and they've done that, and the bill's already been run through, it's already been paid, and you can scream because they left $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000.
Oh, that's so frustrating.
It is.
Oh, wow.
I don't blame people. They just don't know.
Well, David, hey, I thank you so much for coming on the show today. I look forward to getting this out to my clients. I personally have learned some pretty good stuff here, and we just really appreciate you.
Well, you're more than welcome. You're more than welcome. It's good to be here. Thank you so much, Jeff.
You've been listening to Kelly Can Help with Jeff Kelly. Reach out to the law office of Jeffrey B. Kelly today by phone 706-295-0030 in Rome or visit kellycanhelp.com.